Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
A U.S. representative challenges Florida's congressional map in court, but cases that might have helped her seem to be undermining her efforts.
So, bottom line is, although the cases are related as the very specific point of law, they are somewhat different.
Also this week, after many years, there's at least a partial resolution of a fight over health care for low-income kids.
It has not been consistent across the board, and that's what this, the results of this settlement agreement will achieve.
We'll also meet some law enforcers from all over the country who met in Florida this week to talk about community policing and hear from an expert on terrorism and torture who's worried America could be on the way to fighting evil with evil. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. A redrawn congressional district line continues to be a battle line for a veteran member of Congress. Democratic Congresswoman Corinne Brown is holding her breath in hopes that a panel of federal judges will agree to throw out the newest iteration of Florida's congressional map. Nick Evans reports recent rulings may not be helping her cause.
A few weeks ago, Representative Corinne Brown brought three busloads of supporters to a Tallahassee federal courthouse in support of her bid to throw out Florida's new congressional map. The Jacksonville Democrat then took the group to a Tallahassee buffet restaurant, addressing the supporters with a bullhorn.
25 prisons in the district. Wow. 25 prisons. The present district have three. 25 prisons. There is not another district in the entire United States with 25 prisons.
Brown says this artificially inflates the African-American population and constitutes a violation of the Voting Rights Act because it diminishes the voting power of a minority. And with recent events in Jefferson County, it might seem like she's got a point.
Okay, we have a motion and a second on the floor of the Plan 1A-1 map. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Passed unanimously. And at this time, I'm going to...
That's Jefferson County Commission Chair Stephen Walker. He and his fellow commissioners approved new municipal boundaries a week ago, shortly after the school board approved the same lines, too, and county officials submitted the new plan in federal court Monday. They were forced into the changes because one district houses a large prison, and the ACLU argued counting the prisoners gave that district's voters greater representation in government.
Well, the Jefferson County redistricting case, again, does have some similarities to Corinne Brown's argument.
This is University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett. He grants both cases are looking at what to do with a disenfranchised population of inmates, but they rely on different arguments. The Jefferson case was built on simple population deviation, but Brown's case is looking at minority representation. And Jewett says the ruling in the Jefferson case is probably too narrow to support Brown.
He basically made a very narrow decision and specifically said, well, this would probably be different if we were talking about state House districts or state Senate districts or even congressional districts. So, again, it's related to Corinne Brown's issue, absolutely, because they're both looking at counting whether or not you can count prison population. But I'm not sure from the Jefferson County ruling, again, that we can guess what the federal courts may do with Corinne Brown's suit.
Muddying the water further is the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Evanwell v. Abbott. Here's Justice Samuel Alito grilling one of the lawyers with a hypothetical situation that might sound familiar.
You have a rural district with a huge prison and very few other inhabitants. So, you have a neighboring district that has no prison. So in one district you have that 10% of the population are eligible voters, in the other district 90% of the population are eligible voters. That would be okay.
So, Your Honor, 2 points in response.
In a unanimous opinion, the court determined when it comes to reapportionment, Texas lawmakers can count disenfranchised individuals, whether they be in prison, undocumented, or simply too young to vote. The challengers argued only voters should be counted.
And what the court said was that while a state does not necessarily have to use all residents when they're counting up and getting ready to apportion their districts, They are certainly allowed to do that.
So, for those keeping score, there's a federal district court saying Jefferson County can't count prisoners, while the U.S. Supreme Court is saying Texas can. But neither decision seems to help Brown. The Supreme Court's ruling backs up the Florida legislature's use of total population. But in court, Brown has largely shied away from that line of argument anyway. Meanwhile, it seems the judge in the Jefferson County case crafted his decision narrowly enough to exclude Brown's claim. That same judge is presiding over Brown's case. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
When it comes to public policy, a few things can be resolved in a matter of days, if not weeks. More often, though, disagreements can consume many months or even years. A decade-long fight over Medicaid has finally come to a close. Parents and organizations providing health care to kids sued the state, saying Florida's old Medicaid program wasn't serving kids. And we get that story from Lynn Hatter.
The Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics says it views one-on-one communication opportunities with state healthcare agencies as the biggest win in a settlement over a decade-long lawsuit over children's Medicaid healthcare. Tommy Scheckman heads the academy.
Not only trying to deal with the current issues and problems, but really work together collaboratively to find solutions to improve how we deliver healthcare. And I think that's a challenge. For 10 past years, we have not been able to sit at the table with the state, and now we will have that opportunity.
The settlement calls on the state to find ways to increase the number of kids getting preventative care, and it gives providers a way to earn reimbursement rates near Medicare levels. That's closer to a market rate. The lawsuit began in 2005, and in 2011, the state handed Medicaid over to HMOs to administer. The new incarnation is called Medicaid Managed Care. Have you all seen any increase in your reimbursement rates, any progress in trying to hit that Medicare level under Medicaid managed care?
Some of the companies have started with what we call, pay for performance or enhanced payments for delivering on quality care metrics, or paying for having what's looked at as a patient-centered medical home. And so we have seen some variation between the managed care companies, but it has not been a consistent across the board. And that's what this, the results of this settlement agreement will achieve.
Right now, we're still not at Medicare levels.
Well, there are some physicians who may be receiving that, but the majority currently are not.
And that's a big deal. Right, because this has been a historical problem within Medicaid.
Correct. And this is an issue that research has, shown not just here in Florida, but in many states with the Medicaid system, that improving fee schedules helps increase number of pediatricians that are willing to accept Medicaid or open their what we call their panels to more Medicaid children, so that there are a number of physicians who certainly currently take Medicaid, but they may limit their practice to 5% or 10% of Medicaid recipients.
Florida's rate for uninsured children remains one of the highest in the nation. There's been tremendous progress in reducing that rate in recent years, but according to a report from Georgetown University, 378,000 kids still don't have health insurance. And Scheckman says about 70% of them are currently eligible for Medicaid. It's this group of kids that's proving hardest to reach.
There hasn't been statewide efforts in the last few years to do sort of across-the-board outreach or targeted outreach. Again, the settlement speaks to that and states that this is now an obligation not only of the health plans but also of the state.
The settlement deal calls on state agencies to find ways to get those kids into the system. Scheckman says while it's not a panacea, expanding Medicaid to more adults could help. He says if parents get insured, they're more likely to get their kids covered too. But the Florida legislature continues to reject such an expansion under the Affordable Care Act. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, law enforcers from around the country come to North Florida to talk about better relations with the communities they serve.
We live in a trauma-filled city where the citizens, everybody, have learned to coexist with that trauma, but do it very poorly.
In case you're counting, all 272 bills passed by the legislature this session made it to Governor Rick Scott's desk. That includes a bill that would create a formula for alimony awards.
It's trying to remove the emotion from a situation that is very emotional for all people involved and moving it to the financial decision.
And one of America's top experts on terrorism and torture warns the United States in trying to overcome evil adversaries runs the risk of becoming just as evil as they are. Law enforcement officers from Ferguson, Baltimore, and Sanford, Florida headed to Gadsden County this week for a conference on community policing. Kate Payne reports officers from across the state came together to share their experiences.
From a park in Cleveland to the streets of Baltimore to a church in Charleston, the killings of black people, many of them young, many at the hands of police, those killings are shaking the nation. This week, officers from some of those cities came together to talk about the killings in their communities and their attempts to rebuild public trust.
We live in a trauma-filled city where the citizens, everybody, have learned to coexist with that trauma but do it very poorly, to the point where you see little children, when another body drops, they look at it and say, oh, that's just JoJo, and keep playing.
That's Baltimore Police Officer Melvin Russell talking about his city where Freddie Gray died in the back of a police van. But the same trauma is felt in any number of American cities, with bad schools, not enough jobs, and too many people in jail. The protests in Ferguson, Missouri, began with the killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. But Captain Ron Johnson of the State Highway Patrol says the protest wasn't just about the shooting.
It's about single mothers trying to raise their families. It was about sexual preferences people were out there. It was about people that were being different. It was about schools. It was about jobs.
Cecil Smith became the chief of Sanford Police Department after George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin in 2012. Smith says to understand the protests, people have to know the history.
Some of you may not realize that Jackie Robinson was came to Sanford to play at the Memorial Field when he was a Dodger. Essentially what happened with Jackie Robinson, he was essentially chased out of the city. People in the community still remembered the things that happened with Jackie Robinson.
It was a turning point when Ron Johnson left behind the tanks and SWAT teams and became the first uniformed officer to march with protesters in Ferguson. He redefined the relationship between the police and the public.
Like I can tell you, there was one night where there's a father with no shirt on. And there's two troopers who have him handcuffed behind his back. And they're walking down the middle of the street. And it's late, most of the crowd is gone. And they're walking down the middle of the street. Behind him is his son. He's looking at his father walk with his hands behind his back, and the little boy is walking behind him with his hands behind his back.
Johnson told the troopers to let the father go, that his son shouldn't see this.
I said, what are you teaching me? I said, I want you to take him home.
Speakers conceded at the heart of so many of these incidents is race and prejudice. Captain Tony Raimondo was one of the first on the scene when Trayvon Martin was shot. Now he's addressing police bias in Sanford, starting with his own.
I have never witnessed a man or woman put his or her gear on and say, I'm going to go police population X tonight. That's not the way we do it, except being exposed to the science in the manner that I have been now, I understand that I police in a biased manner previously.
Researchers say relatively few people act on overt racism, but everyone has implicit biases that steer their actions subconsciously. Raimondo says the challenge is recognizing and overcoming those prejudices.
One of the ways that we mitigate that bias is through contact theory. That is, putting our police officers in proximity to the public in positive environments, positive, non-enforcement related things. Because what that does is it exposes our officers to counter stereotyping.
Other departments across the state are implementing this training and re-examining how they police. And underneath the surface, the root causes of unrest remain: poverty, violence, and hardship. But when it comes down to it, Ron Johnson says the police and the community have the same message. Don't judge me by what others have done. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Florida has the second highest incidence of Alzheimer's disease in the nation. A new initiative aims to make more communities across the state dementia-friendly. And as Sasha Cordner reports, the first area chosen to pilot that effort is the state's capital city region.
Dr. Regina Sofer calls herself a, quote, proud caregiver. She cares for her mother, who has Alzheimer's and was officially diagnosed in 2008.
I started my caregiving journey in 1995 when my dad had a stroke. And then in regards to caring for my mother, that started when I moved them here from Alabama with me in 2004. And my pops passed in 2008, and so there was a one-to-one because of the dementia diagnosis. And the doctor indicated that she should not be left alone for any period of time. So that's when the joys and the challenges really began.
She says there are more joys than challenges.
The joys associated with it is to see my loved one still smile at me, to make sure that she has her special treats, to know that she knows that she is loved and that she's being engaged even at the level that she is in her journey with this disease.
Still, Sofer admits caregivers have to be prepared for the challenges that come their way.
The challenges, energy level, resources, time, the whole issue of you becoming less of a person as you give yourself to another person, those are real issues that every caregiver goes through. And you have to balance that out to say, this is not a short journey. You may have not known that going in, but the sustaining factor in most relationships is love and compassion.
That's why she's on board with a new effort called Dementia Care and Cure Initiative. It was recently unveiled by Florida Department of Elder Affairs Secretary Sam Verghese at the Tallahassee Senior Center.
I'm happy here today to announce that the city of Tallahassee and Leon County is going to be the first dementia caring community in Florida.
It's a collaborative effort between state, county, and local officials to make communities more dementia-friendly by taking action on the local level. And Verghese says Florida has a real need.
There's over 500,000 people that are affected by this issue. 500,000 that are diagnosed with Alzheimer's alone, just one type of dementia. And you think about all the people that are affected, that includes the families, that includes caregivers. And there's over 1.1 million caregivers that are dealing with dementia-related type issues. That's a lot of people. That's millions of Floridians that are living and dealing with this issue day in and day out. And there's thousands in Tallahassee alone.
Verghese says through the initiative, they'll take several different approaches, like raising awareness of the issue. That includes showing movies highlighting dementia. He says there's also community assistance.
We want to help first responders be able to identify how this might look if they were to run into it out in the street. We want to help medical providers, primary care physicians, as they see people come in and patients. They're the first line of defense when it comes to diagnosing this. So we want to help them have an opportunity to understand the issue. And then we talk about advocating for care and cure. That has to do with helping caregivers get help, like going to an adult daycare center so that they can work a normal day job and not have to always look after their loved one. Because with dementia, it's kind of a 24/7 monitoring type of situation.
While Verghese says the overall goal is to spread this initiative statewide, right now he's focused on seeing how things go in Tallahassee.
So we're going to continually have feedback here about what's working, what's not working, because I believe in doing things right where you're at and seeing good progress and then moving to another community. Because the key is this, it does no good to announce something if there's not going to be real results.
And Tallahassee City Commissioner Gil Ziffer says he's excited.
So we're glad that Tallahassee and Leon County are part of this, that we can have state, that we can have county and city work together. We're going to attack this. We're going to be the light at the top of the stage, shining down on all other cities and all other counties. We're looking forward to that.
And Sofer says she can't wait as well.
It's going to make it easier for people to go into different venues and not have their loved one hidden or treated like a person non gratis, because that loved one is still there. In spite of the outward manifestations of dementia, that person still exists.
The next step is for Verghese's agency and local leaders to develop a Dementia Care and Cure Initiative Advisory Council, develop a work plan, and start coming up with recommendations on how to proceed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
All of the bills passed by Florida lawmakers during the recent legislative session have now made it to Governor Rick Scott's desk. Regan McCarthy reports the final bill sent to the governor would create a formula for awarding alimony payments.
Among the bills now on the governor's desk is a measure that would create a new formula for awarding alimony payments. Bill's sponsor, Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell, says the measure is an attempt to take some of the emotion out of a divorce proceeding.
What this bill does do is it says that we're going to have a formula to the state that's going to have an idea of a presumption of how you could award alimony based on the duration of the marriage and based on the income disparities between the two individuals. So what it's doing with the award of alimony is trying to remove the emotion from a situation that is very emotional for all people involved and moving it to the financial decision.
But there was plenty of emotion left during the legislature's discussion of the bill. Tampa Democratic Senator Arthenia Joyner calls the measure an assault on alimony recipients. During a committee meeting on the measure, she raised concerns about the impact the measure could have on women who gave up their careers to become stay-at-home moms.
I know there are persons who are tired of paying, but I know on the flip side, if I gave up everything in my career for a person to raise their children, and then I get kicked to the curb when I get 55 or 60, some young pretty thing
and
comes
Joyner,
in,
if you can wrap
and
up,
he no longer
please.
Wants me, and now you get subjected to this because that person wants to live a life of luxury or good times, and heck with all that I've contributed as a woman to the marriage and the rearing of the
and
children.
So-
One provision women's rights advocates like Barbara Devane found particularly concerning would let a person paying alimony ask for an adjustment if the recipient gets a 10% raise.
Maybe you go out and you can find a little job after staying at home all these years and you're older, and there is age discrimination in hiring. And also, you're way behind on your skills at finding a job, keeping a job, getting a job, and you get a $10 an hour job, and you get a $1 an hour raise, and now you're making $11 an hour, and you have to go back to court because your ex-husband's going to run, try to get a modification. How are you going to afford one of these high-priced attorneys?
Meanwhile, Natalie Sohn, who says she'll be paying alimony likely for the rest of her life after just 15 years of marriage, says she disagrees with Devane's characterization.
Women are not helpless. 50% of the workforce is women. And to even say that if somebody gets divorced, which 50% of the population does now, that women will be on welfare? How insulting to women.
Sohn says she supports the proposed reforms because they could make it possible for her to eventually retire. The bill also requires judges to begin custody decisions with the assumption that equal time with both parents is in the best interest of the child. Scott has until Tuesday the 19th to take action on the measure. He can sign it, let it pass without his signature, or veto it. Last year, the governor vetoed similar alimony reform legislation because of concerns that it could be applied retroactively. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Finally this week, Florida's capital city is a regular stopover for some pretty high-powered people, among them international policy authorities who frequently share their thoughts with Florida State University students at the school's College of Law, while also attracting members of the Capitol Press Corps. Promising to use torture on ISIS detainees is a guaranteed applause line for GOP presidential candidates nowadays, and that comes as no surprise to Harvard Law professor Alberto Mora. But as Jim Ash reports, the former Pentagon lawyer is warning the rhetoric is damaging America's reputation abroad and handing the nation's enemies a valuable tool.
Alberto Mora has more reasons than most to cheer Donald Trump's call for reversing the ban on torture. After all, the former U.S. Navy General Counsel was in the Pentagon on 9/11 when terrorists crashed a 757 into the building. But when Mora heard detainees were being waterboarded at the Marine base in Guantanamo, and that there were White House torture memos justifying it, he fought back from the inside. In a guest lecture this week, Moore told Florida State University law students why he thinks President George W. Bush made a huge mistake.
The net result of this is that the zone of individual protection from cruelty has shrunk, personal rights and liberty have been diminished, and the United States has established the strongest and most formidable precedent for the proposition that immunity from accountability for torture is acceptable in democratic nations.
Mora also has more reason than most to fear state-sanctioned abuse. He was 8 when his parents fled Castro's Cuba for Jackson, Mississippi. When he worked for the Department of Defense, the University of Miami Law School grad served as the U.S. Navy's chief ethics officer. U.S. torture of detainees at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib helped terrorist leaders recruit thousands of fighters, Mora says.
The U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff in 2005 determined that the number one and number two identifiable causes of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq in 2005 were number one, Abu Ghraib, and number two, Guantanamo.
U.S. diplomats lost the moral high ground they used so effectively to shape foreign policy since the end of World War II, Mora argues. And as a result, he says, the U.S. has also lost leverage to protect its own citizens and soldiers.
The United States might be more restrained in our use of cruelty than other states, but if Syria, North Korea, or Cuba decided to be completely unconstrained, then who could object? The answer is, of course, no one.
That's why, Morris says, there's more urgency than ever to shut down Guantanamo.
Guantanamo is a crime scene where the crime of torture was committed with impunity. For many around the world, the term Guantanamo has not unfairly come to symbolize and be synonymous with the term American injustice. Every person here should regard that as intolerable.
Attempts by foreign torture victims to sue in U.S. courts have been dismissed on national secrecy grounds, Mora says. One torture victim who was kidnapped by the CIA by mistake was compensated by a Canadian court, Mora says. One FSU law student wanted to know about the fallout for the legal profession.
Has there been any type of professional discipline? And if so, how do you think that that could influence other aspects of accountability?
Hardly, Morris says. John Yoo, a former White House counsel and author of the torture memos, is a professor at Berkeley. Yoo's former boss is a federal appeals judge. But those who participated at the highest levels are scorned by their colleagues, Morris says.
These memoranda that permitted these policies were gross violations of legal professionalism and gross violations of ethical requirements for individual attorneys. That judgment is not insignificant.
Morris says he's encouraged that Harvard students are demanding changes in the law school curriculum. Morris says any president considering the use of torture would do well to remember the words of French philosopher Albert Camus.
In fighting a war, we must take care not to use those weapons that would destroy what we seek to protect. And my message today is that torture is exactly that kind of weapon.
Morris' speech marked the 25th anniversary of the Journal of Transnational Law and Policy. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust. 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.